We have done chapter 1 of Brueggemann, The Bible Makes Sense. What he's saying is, what he's saying in the book is, please meet my friend. My friend is the Bible. For you to have a nice visit with the Bible, you need to understand what the Bible thinks like and where it came from and its culture and its language and its habits. Just like any good friend. If you don't have a feeling for where your friend came from, you talk past each other. So he says, let's meet my friend. In the first chapter, what he's tried to do is to say, you and I have a mind, probably have a mindset, a way of thinking that is contrary to the Bible's way of thinking. Either we think scientific historical, or we think transcendental, or we think, existential model. He said the way that the Bible talks is covenantal historical. Okay? That's the mindset of the Bible. Covenantal is God and us have a marriage, have a relationship, have a friendship going, and that friendship is found in history. So, now, this edition, the March 11th edition of Christian Century, this sort of jumped off the page. Wolfhart Pannenberg, the German theologian, yeah? What does he write? In how he changed his mind over the last 10 years. God's, note the title of the article, God's presence where?
In history.
All right? We're making connections. Okay. And the subtitle is, there is no direct conceptual approach to God, that is, brainy approach, philosophical approach. You can't get to God by thinking about it a lot, nor from God to human reality. But God's presence is hidden in history, in the particulars of history. Okay? We already knew that, and it took him 10 years to figure it out, right? So we're doing all right. Not bad, huh? Covenantal historical. Meet my friend. This is where Brueggemann wants to start. The next thing he's going to do is to talk about, and that's what we're going to do today, chapter 2 and chapter 3. He's looking at different kinds of literature in the Bible. From this point on, he's got two things he's going to do. First, he's going to tell us more about what the Bible is and what it's not. The next thing he's going to do is give us the major themes of the Bible. And in a way, if you've ever taken Bethel series, or if you've heard about the Bethel series or anything like that, this is really very good as a summary of the big ideas in the Bible. So he's got two tracks. First, what is this book? Another track is, what are the major themes that we find in the Scriptures? Say, we're going to go into chapter 2, and you'll need a Bible if you've got one with you. I should have made that announcement this morning at breakfast, but I did not. Some of you do. So let's each take this, and we'll go to work on chapter 2. The title of chapter 2 is Nurturing an Historical Imagination. Nurturing an Historical Imagination. Who do you think is an imaginative person in winter program this year? Who's an imaginative person in the village?
Corinne
Schmidt. Name some more. Who are some imaginative people in the village?
Kathy.
She's
a squirrel. I think I missed one.
It was better missed.
We're asking the question, who are imaginative people at Holden Village?
I think Joel.
Joel Oinous. Mm-hmm. He pictures things. Mm-hmm. Right?
So is that Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Knudsen's imagined.
Mary
Olson's imagined. How about our friend this past weekend?
Yeah.
Rich Kammer and the crucifix.
Crucifix in Rockville.
Right.
He's been around a long time.
Are you? I mean, how do you feel about yourself on the imagination scale? Do you feel like you're sort of half asleep, or do you feel like your imagination really works well? How do you feel?
Kind of half. Kind of in the middle.
Sometimes there, and okay. You don't. You're not sure.
Feel very manic.
No.
Mine works overtime.
Okay. Anybody?
What?
You've been reading Embodiment. Do you have any?
I mean,
what?
Yeah,
what kind of man?
Well, any kind.
Sure.
Yeah. Brueggemann has a very, very simple point in chapter 2, and that is to move into the Bible. Requires of us, asks of us to be rather creative, rather imaginative, rather dreamy, even. But dreamy, but a controlled dreaminess. Okay? That's a contradictory, it's not a contradictory statement.
It's a paradox.
It's a paradox, thank you. Right. Rich Kammer is imaginative. But he can do what he does because he knows color, he knows shape, he knows theology, he knows put water on this stuff and it runs. I mean, he's done this stuff before, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's got an imagination that's enriched by some discipline. That's the simple point of chapter 2. The point is, of chapter 2 is, that you and I, the Bible invites us to have an historical imagination. An historical imagination. Before we get into it, right off the top of your head, what's it mean? An historical imagination.
You need to try to be able to put yourself into the historical setting of the Bible.
Okay, one thing it means is to go back and get into someone else's history. What else does historical imagination mean?
To be grounded in our own place and time.
So what does that mean?
kind of, to be in touch with reality, I guess.
Historical imagination. In other words, today is history?
Yeah, not just to go floating off, but to have some sort of a grounding.
Now that's, you just changed there.
No, taking from history and putting it today.
Is that what you mean?
No, I mean living in the fact that today is history.
Okay. March 1981 at Holton Village is a historical event.
Yeah.
Does it feel like that?
Yeah.
No.
It's like a nice day to go skiing. What else can we say? Okay. Kit, well, thank you for that. We don't necessarily...
Nobody agrees with you.
But it's a great idea. Leela, you had enough. Another one that didn't go with Kit's there. What was yours?
That you take some history and apply it today. I'm using... I don't know how I said it before.
No, you said it better before. But that's okay. The history alive today, or the... Something like that?
Yeah.
We go back, that now is history, that the past is now too, okay? Leela rosemalled a food dryer at our house. You know what rosemalling is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
They have it in Texas?
No, but I know what it is. They don't have lutefisk in Texas either, but I know what that is. So I think they're related somehow, right?
In general. Background.
Rosemalling is artistic history that is alive today. What else does historical imagination mean? That's all?
That's all there is.
Three things.
Oh, there's gotta be more. Does it have anything to do with the people, no. Their imaginations, people
in
history?
Huh. How, oh, like Moses, mm-hmm. Moses was creative.
And all his wives,
yeah. Jesus and the disciples were creative. Yes, it does. Yeah. Oh, let's put down, Holly says, old folks were creative too. Huh? Or dead people were creative? No, how do we say it? Historical figures.
Dead people had more character.
Historical figures were creative too. All right. Now, Holly Henderson says that certainly must be the end of it. There can't be any more.
There can't be any more.
Oh, there may be more.
There's lots more room on the board.
Yes, there is.
More.
We'll find some more. Introductory comments.
I'm just blown away that that guy's trash and Mother Teresa. I just can't get with
it. Is that right?
I just can't.
Why don't you read the article first?
The whole my day is ruined.
Oh, dear. Oh,
awful. You can trash compact it this afternoon and nothing.
All right. Introductory comments. An important purpose of Bible reading and Bible study is to become a responsible participant in covenantal history.
Whoa.
Whoa. Okay. What does covenantal history mean?
Covenant. Anyone? The promise.
What promise?
God's
God promise, which is what?
Be our God, we be his people.
All right. Covenantal history, it goes back to what person? To start
Abraham.
With. Abraham through... Name some more folks in the...
Isaac, Jacob, Moses,
Jesus,
David,
Paul.
Jesus.
All right. To be a responsible...
John Tram.
To be a responsible participant in covenantal history.
And Mother Teresa.
And Mother Teresa.
How does...
But not Martin Marty.
One.
How does one become a responsible participant in covenantal history?
Read the Bible as insiders.
Thank you.
Good.
Take the covenant on yourself. You become part of the people.
You join the story. All right. Responsible participant is to join the story. Okay. Is it anything in addition to joining the story? Is it more than just joining the story?
Checking out reruns of the story.
Okay. Checking out reruns of the story. As you've heard it, what else is it? To be a responsible participant in the
tell
story.
Tell other people.
Adding to it.
Tell others is just a repeat. Lila adds another dimension, add to the story. We sit around here, and just about every other session, somebody mentions Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. You notice this?
Yeah.
Over and over and over. This person has become, for us, an archetype, a model. I mean, in some ways, he's more alive than Abraham. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just an extremely important person. Surrounded by powerful myth, not untruth, but powerful. I mean, you say the name, and there's energy behind the name. Okay. So what he was a responsible participant in covenantal history. He took the story, and he did what Leila just said. He took the story of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jesus, and the rest, and he added to the story. Okay. So you and I pick up more vibrations through history. All right. To do that, as we have already heard from Kathy, who read ahead, bless her heart, to do that, we need to read the Bible as insiders. We are outsiders to the Bible's language, like Hebrew, for example. I mean, who speaks Yiddish in the room? We're outsiders to Greek. We're outsiders to Aramaic. We don't know about shepherding, right? 99 sheep in one. What do we know? Right? We're all just rookies. We're living at Burger King, and they're talking about sheep, right?
That's right.
Kind of we're hurting. Sure, we are. We're outsiders to its language, to its thought, to its history, and to its culture. All very obvious. The following is a process whereby outsiders become insiders. Conversion theology teaches that one becomes an insider on the story. How?
By becoming converted.
You get converted.
Except in Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior.
So faith.
See that in the next session.
You become an insider by accepting Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior. Okay. Is that true?
Period. Yes.
Sure, it's true. Yeah, that's true.
That still doesn't help you understand shepherding.
That's right.
Well, they argue that you don't need to understand shepherding. You just read it as it is.
That's one way to become an insider. What are some Lutheran avenues to become an insider?
Study.
Go to church, huh?
Study.
Study what?
History, all that good stuff.
Okay.
Go to seminary.
Go to seminary. What else?
Baptism.
Confirmation.
Confirmation class. You get a robe on, a little flower, and everybody sweats a lot.
Go to Sunday school.
Go to Sunday school, sure.
Be an usher.
Check the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
Be an usher. Be an altar guild.
First, there are mundane things to learn, he says. And I think it's interesting that a man whose life is committed to Old Testament study says, look at folks, this is, some of this stuff is really boring. You want to know that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think it's marvelous that a man that this fellow will say that.
Mm-hmm.
There, he calls it mundane. Other times, in the next chapter we're going to look at, he uses the word boring to describe certain sections of the book of Exodus, for example. I love it.
He's right.
Yeah, he's right. It is boring. It's marvelous to even admit it. Okay, certain mundane things to learn, like history, the historical chronology, that Abraham comes before Jesus.
That's significant. Yeah.
And one of the things maybe that we shortchange ourselves on here is very simple, basic, fundamental life. When was Abraham? Who was Abraham's son? Who was Abraham's son, grandson? And when did the exile happen? And who was King David? And all this stuff, remember, we learned in third grade, but all of us have forgotten it since then.
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Smith, last winter, did a wonderful thing. All he did was tell Old Testament stories.
Oh.
Not all he did. One of the things he did was Bible stories.
That's good.
And it was just exciting to hear King David. But who is this David guy again? We use the name, but we don't know the story anymore. We forget them. So that was fun. Something we should maybe think about doing.
Mm-hmm.
To learn chronology, geography, international relations, Syria, Babylon, etc., Egypt, religio-cultural crises, which is what?
War.
Yeah, for example. Major institutions of the people of Israel and the church. Now what he gives us in chapter 2 is a list of books. There were about 10 books he lists on page 31 that are helpful for getting some of this basic stuff down. And you'll find them in the library, and you'll also find them very interesting reading. Davy Napier, Norm Gottwell, Walt Harrelson, Bernard Anderson, lots of other people. And they're all, what he lists for us here are very readable books that tell very basic stories. Okay. But now, after you get that stuff, he says, we also need to become part of the covenantal historical story, that is, to have an historical imagination. Now, he does two things. First, he's going to talk about the need for imagination. Then he's going to say imagination has to be shaped by history. And then he's going to give us an example, the example of bread, and we'll kind of follow that through quickly. Let's move ahead because the next chapter is longer and an important one. Our imagination must always, excuse me, I'm in the wrong place. Imagination is an openness and a sensitivity to the pulses of meaning that can be perceived as we reflect upon the historical experience of Israel and the church. Pulses of meaning, like bread. You say bread to Jews and it means a whole ton. Say bread to us, it means lots. It doesn't mean just Mary Olson in the bakery. It means Eucharist. It means lots of things, right? Pulses of meaning that keep going through generations. For example, Pharaoh is a symbol of oppression. When Martin Luther King uses the word Pharaoh, you know he's not giving you a Bible story, a history lesson, right? You know, something else is going on. Pharaoh's alive and well today. Okay. Bread is a symbol of nourishment. So every story about liberation is a new story about Pharaoh. There was the original Pharaoh story. Then there are lots of little Pharaoh stories in the Old Testament and the New Testament. They all relate to the first story. And beyond that, Luther talked a lot about Pharaoh and about captivity, the captivity of the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, so the whole thing just keeps going on. Martin Luther King talks about Pharaoh and the captivity of the people. Let my people go. What is all goes back to the original story. To the and it just keeps echoing off that original. Leila said, no, who was it? Michelle said that the historical figures were creative. See, the original event, the original Pharaoh and Exodus thing happened. And then through the history, we read in the Old Testament and the New Testament, people picked up that old story, just like Martin Luther King picked it up, and kept echoing that thing. They were very imaginative in the use of the original story. Imagination is the opposite of facts that can be proven. I mean, to discuss whether or not the Red Sea actually opened and the people of Israel fled across the dry rocks at the bottom of the Red Sea, and then the ocean and the water flooded down on top of the chasing Egyptian army. When Cecil B. DeMille movie, remember that? He ran the chariots through the water and then the water came in. To argue about whether or not that really happened. It's just such a gross waste of time. I mean, it's also just, it's just dumb. It's totally unproductive.
I like the challenge
with
this
one, by the way. Yeah, I mean, it's too beautiful of a story to get stuck up on whether or not, you know, what, the, yeah, if this guy was really in the belly of a big fish. It's not, see, what do we remember? We hear Jonah, we think fish, right?
You can't run away.
That's that small, that's the point of the story. You can't
hide.
Yeah, run and God will chase. That's the point of the story. It's a wonderful story. All we remember is the little fish part of it, which is a very, very small part of an otherwise beautiful little short story. You run, God will chase. Imagination is the opposite of facts that can be proven. Imagination gives vitality, it gives possibility, it gives promise. The Bible is passed on because fresh dimensions of meaning are seen in each generation. Think of your own family. Fresh dimensions of meaning are seen in each generation. When your grandmother heard Exodus, what did she think of? Your grandma. When she heard the Exodus story, what did she think of? When my grandma heard Exodus, she it meant a lot to her. It meant, I'm 17 years old, I'm leaving Norway, and I'm going to Dakota, where I've never been, and I'm never coming home. Okay? You feel that? Mm-hmm. Get that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what it meant to my grandma. That's what Exodus meant. That God delivered her. I mean, she couldn't stay in Norway. There was no food. There was no work. There were too many kids. They had to leave. So they were captive. They were prisoners in Egypt, and they had to get out of there. So they came to Dakota. She was 17 years old, never went home. I have her trunk. My mom has her trunk. It's beautiful. It's old. It's got her name on the top. It was on the ship with her. That's what she. Now my mom and my dad, when they heard Egypt or deliverance, what did they think? They thought something else. When I hear the Exodus story, what rings my bell? Or yours? Think? What's going on? Martin Luther King, for me, it's Martin Luther King, South Africa, it's America, and America versus the rest of the world, and all those kind of questions. That's, in every generation, now Eric and Matt have to come up with their own vibrations on the Exodus story. If they don't, they don't own them. They can't own my story, but their bells have to be rung. Out of their own story, out of their own history. And they will be wrong, you know, because there'll be an Exodus. So there'll be an Exodus, and a need for deliverance, and a captivity, and an oppression somewhere in their life that they're going to, at a certain stage in their life, and it's gonna ring their bell. I hope it'll ring their bell. My job, mostly, is to keep telling that story to them. And then sooner or later, someday, click, they're going to connect that old 6,000-year-old story to their own life, and the new historical imagination just keeps going on. To deal with the old story with imagination requires of us energy and requires boldness. Energy. It takes energy to say Egypt. Excuse me. It takes energy to say the deliverance from Egypt is the black people's deliverance in the United States. It takes energy to say that, to get inside the story. It also takes boldness, because there's a lot of people who are going to object to that. Mm-hmm. Who are going to say, no, because that's a different whole different thing. But it's some people have to say, no, it's not a different thing. It's precisely the point. And you may be wrong about how you connect it, which is still, but connections have to be made. Okay, imagination. But now he tempers this in the next section. Imagination shaped by history, he goes on to say. But our imagination must always be an historical imagination. It must be more than innovative, cutesy thinking. It is innovation shaped by a particular historical experience. We return to the concrete story of Israel and to the church for our new meanings. History is cold, dead, and precise. I mean, it's gone, right? It's boring. But imagination is fresh and alive. The two are to be held in tension, history and imagination. History keeps our imagination concrete and particular. Imagination sets it loose in new directions. There's a constant tension. The historical without imagination is boring. You fall asleep. Imagination without history is just fantasy trip. When the history has imagination, we then have a live memory going on. Live memory. Now, an example of this whole thing is bread. And it's so long, I don't think we'll do it. You'll have to do it on your own. Let's just read it. Exodus 16 tells the bread story, bread in the wilderness. Israel is in the wilderness. God is present with surprises, namely bread. The Bible does not explain this, but only proclaims it. I mean, the Bible doesn't say, well, this manna, see, what it really was a combination. This is the true story. I read one time somebody who wrote an essay on the scientific basis for manna in the desert. This is true. This person went to the desert and with the right dew point and the right sort of rocks, and all there's a sort of crusty thing that grows in certain parts of the Sinai based on certain weather conditions. And this article in detail, it's like printed in Scientific American or some really heavyweight publication like that. They explain how it happened. I mean, who cares, right?
I think it's kind of
interesting. It's interesting, but who cares? I mean,
yeah.
But no, let me say, it's interesting and it's... It takes all the zip out of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Like having cameras on your wedding night or something. I'm going to explain what's happening here.
Right.
And you're going, I think you've missed the point.
Whoa. The Bible does not explain where the bread came from, only proclaims it. In the story, Israel remembers... In the story of bread in Exodus 16, Israel remembers slavery, it remembers God's grace, it remembers wilderness wandering, it remembers fragile dependence on God, it remembers not submitting to secure slavery back in Egypt, we want to go home, remember? And it remembers not owning dependable bakeries. All these things. The bread story, in other words, has about 10 layers of meaning. Lots and lots of layers of meaning. The bread story is a prism through which Israel sees all of its history. Not only one, not the only prism, but it is a central prism through which all of its history is seen. Now, bread keeps coming back in biblical literature. It's found in Isaiah in the 6th century BC. It's found in Mark, and it's found in 100 other places. Insiders derive life and hope from bread stories. Outsiders think we're talking about, I mean, what are we talking about? Right? It doesn't make any sense to outsiders. Insiders say, yeah, that story's got lots of power to it. Now, more reflections on bread. Other reflections. We have these other reflections when we have an historical imagination. Okay. The bread business in the Bible goes from Old Testament all through the book of Revelation. But now there's more. Number one, it helps us understand the Eucharist. If bread rings bells in our head, we understand world hunger because of the bread image. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
We connect to that. It helps us to become critical of a consumer culture that says bread is everything. See?
Or that we have to produce
bread. Yeah. Or that we have to own the bakery.
Right.
Okay. So man in the wilderness is not just man in the wilderness. I mean, it's about everything. It's about what we're going to talk about at the forum. How many color TVs does every house have to have?
Six.
Right. Four. Another thing it does, that we reject technical reason, which explains everything, but does not understand the gift. That's another dimension. And the meanings go on and on as big as a blackboard would be. The meanings go on and on for insiders who feel the pulse of the story alive and well within the community today.
It's interesting that the organization we're familiar with is Bread for the World,
uh-huh.
Not Food for the World. And literally most of the people out there are not
eating bread.
Bread. They're
yeah,
eating
that's
grain.
Right. That's
the
right.
Bread has got all this imagery
yep.
and all this
yep.
meaning. And that's what we use to symbolize.
The slang word for money.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Lots of. Do you want to say anything about this now? Historical imagination? Nope.
We're in favor of it.
I think from rereading it a few times, I think the key, let me summarize what I think is the key point. The key point is that imagination without an exact historical base is just a fantasy trip.
Mm-hmm.
Historical base without imagination is dumb, is boring, to use his words.
Mm-hmm.
Both tensions.
And that's so either one of those is okay for anything else, but when talking about the Bible,
you're going to need both.
You're going to need
both. Yep, you got to have both. Sunday school, teaching little kids about the Red Sea and all that stuff is very, very important. It's very, very crucial. It's not it's not an irrelevant little, what are we doing this one? This is really dumb. Look at these kids. They don't want to open the Red Sea. The heck they don't. that's a model that's going to shape their lives. Introductory comments. The Bible is put together in a strange way.
That's very comforting.
Why is that comforting?
Because it is put together in a strange way. I'm not an Old Testament professor, but I can just take one look at it, quick
and
glance,
and
put that together.
And say this
and
is...
that fits my experience. Why do you have to be so obtuse, God?
Nobody has been saying the same thing to you.
That's probably true.
In other words, you have read the Old Testament, and you end up by and you end up saying,
"What?
What is this?" Thank you. Excuse me, I'm going to go read Time Magazine or something. How's beautiful?
No, I mean I read a lot, but I read books about the Bible and not the Bible because the Bible doesn't make sense. The Bible, I don't understand what the point is.
That's what the book is.
That's
for.
What the book is for.
Anybody else feel the Bible's put together in a strange way?
Okay.
You do? Strange? Huh? What others? What's the strange? You use the word obtuse. What else?
Some of it just isn't it, when it's not chronological order and stuff. It's kind of jumps around.
Two creation stories. I'm gonna appreciate
that.
Cumbersome. 66 books stuck together. Holly said no
chronology.
No chronology.
The chronology's messed up.
Yeah.
out of order.
And they have the same story in two or three different places, and they don't jive.
It's different.
Yes. Story.
Right, and if Mark's the oldest gospel, why didn't they put it in there first?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And in fact,
and
if 1 and 2 Corinthians, which were written quite a few years before Matthew, Mark, Luke, if they were earlier, why don't they put those in first? Mm-hmm. Right?
And if the letter wasn't written by Paul, how come it says the letter by St. Paul?
Which is not fair to us.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, should check that
thing. Huh.
So,
we had a lot of beef in the Bible.
Yeah, one of the things that we are accustomed to when we go to school or when we read books like this book or any book we buy, we are accustomed to the introduction being
in the beginning.
In the beginning. Right, and the conclusion is usually at the end of the book.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of nice.
And
we get kind of used to it.
Middle.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we have a nice, organized book, and that's the way we do stuff. We start at the beginning and we go to the end. The Bible didn't get formed that way, did it?
Mm-hmm.
The Bible got formed
by
through
committee.
Centuries, by committee, by vote of convention, by, you know what the whole thing together is called? A canon. Did you know that?
Yeah.
You know that word? C-A-N-O-N?
Mm-hmm.
The canon, yeah, the books. The Roman Catholic canon is different than the Protestant canon. There are more books in the Roman Catholic Bible. Well, because during the Reformation, some of the books were deemed by the Reformers of inferior quality, and so they were excluded. No, the Pentateuch is the first five books.
Judith and Tobit.
Judith, Tobit.
Maccabees.
Maccabees.
That's
Andrews. No, it's Amos is Old Testament, but there's a new one. Esdras. Esdras is the one you're thinking of. Okay. That's called apocryphal literature or pseudepigraphic literature.
Whoa.
Pseudepigraphic?
Mm-hmm.
It's false writing.
They should be believed it was inspired by God, right? Isn't that the foreground?
Excuse me?
They just didn't believe they were books inspired by God.
They felt like, yeah, kind of.
What's the most recent book that's been incorporated into the Bible? How long ago was it written?
The oldest book?
The most recent one.
The newest book.
The newest book.
Why did
the
you
think
that?
The one last one. Well, at a certain point they had to at a convention, they had to decide, that's it, we're not putting any more stuff in.
Is that the way a covenant and an interrelationship between God and his people happens? It stops and then we just look at the way it was?
That's
nothing interesting happening anymore that's worth
the Mormons say that
becoming part of our faith?
You know how
we
feel about
book
them.
On Martin Luther King in the Bible.
There have been movements to incorporate the writings of King into the Bible.
Mm-hmm. I'd vote against that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but why would we?
The Roman Catholic Church has answered Bob's question this way. They say, the scriptures are normative, but in addition to the scriptures, the teachings and traditions of the church, that is, the popes and cardinals, and etc. So, the Bible is the holy word of God, but in addition, the doctrines and later pronouncements of the church, like the fact that the Blessed Virgin Mary ascended into heaven, that was done about 1905, that is Holy Scripture also. So they say there's two places where you get Holy Scripture. One is the Bible, the other is tradition, the traditions of the church. Protestantism has rejected that, saying that the traditions of the church often have contradicted the scriptures themselves and have contradicted each other, and so therefore we can't rely on them. So they threw them all out. I think practically, so what we're left with in the Protestant world is just the scriptures themselves. I think things become holy writ for us, never officially acknowledged as holy scripture. I mean, when I read Bonhoeffer's Life Together, that for me, that's sort of holy writ.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's not good, but sometimes Exodus is boring too,
mm-hmm.
Now, there's no way we're going to get a convention together to decide that that should be included in the Bible, but it doesn't have to be anymore. We've got enough stuff in the book that gives us a way to evaluate Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King and Mother Teresa and anybody else you want to evaluate. So I don't think we need more scriptures. We probably need to study the scriptures we have already more.
Yeah.
And then we've got a big enough deposit that'll give us ways to evaluate all the other holy literature that really is around. That's a cop-out answer. But
I'll bet you that if Russia took over and years later God let us out of Russia,
yes,
it'd make it.
In the Bible?
Yeah. Right. If God parted the Atlantic Ocean,
yeah,
and we all made it away from Russia, and their tanks were all swamped,
yeah,
it'd be in the Bible. Yeah.
Those few of us that were left would add that.
Well,
to the
Bible.
Well, we'd probably lose a lot of our Bibles, and then we have to go back to oral tradition.
Memory.
Oh, that would be cool.
More stuff.
You know, Malcolm Muggeridge wrote a book that I didn't even read, but it still had a big impact on me. It was called The Third Testament.
Yes.
And it talked about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and some new people, and it made me realize that, yeah, there is a whole lot of stuff that we don't call the Bible, but it's real important to us.
Yeah.
Because it speaks, we don't have to do so much imagining to understand where they're coming from.
Yes.
And I trust God's working in their lives.
A fascinating thing to consider is what happens when archaeologists find 3 Corinthians.
Yeah.
Or what happens when they find... There is a book called The Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah.
It's not in the Bible. You read the Gospel of Mark and then you read the Gospel of Thomas, and you too would vote to not include the Gospel of Thomas. There's portions of the Gospel of Thomas that are they're corny.
Is that the one that has all the little stories of his childhood?
Yes, Jesus picks up a rock, throws the rock in the air, turns into a bird.
Uh-huh.
By the way. Okay, that's... But there's other things in the Gospel of Thomas that are very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. Well, we know there are three... That Paul wrote at least 3 letters to the church in Corinth. We've got number 1, actually, which is number 2. Mm-hmm. We don't have number 1. What we call 1 Corinthians is actually 2nd. What we call 2nd is actually 3rd. 1 Corinthians is still hidden in a cave someplace. Or maybe it's all turned to dust. But what happens when they find it?
When archaeologists... Some of the new translations have that stuff in it.
Yes. Oh, all this does. Yeah. Additions and corrections. Okay. Reading from cover to cover, the Bible is put together in a strange way. If you read it from Genesis to Revelation, you will, like Holly, get frustrated, bored, or mad. it just doesn't work. I mean, what do you do with it?
Especially the
end
and the
beginning.
Right.
But everything in between.
You just get all kind of, all this stuff's going on. Mm-hmm. Reading it chronologically is nearly impossible. In other words, you say, please tell me which one to read first. I want to read the oldest one first.
So you start with Genesis and then get lost.
Because Genesis isn't the oldest one. No, Genesis is there because it's a story about the beginnings, but it isn't the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew is there for who knows what reason, but it isn't the oldest at the beginning. Okay? And Revelation isn't the youngest at the book. And the
Doesn't it kind of explain that?
Yes, very helpful. The best way to read it is to put various parts together based on the various functions the literature has. And what we have in Brueggemann now in these 2 little lovely pages is how to read the Bible the best way. Beginning to end, frustrating. Chronologically, nearly impossible. How do we do it then? He says, read it. Note, please, on the second page, the little the concentric circles. He said, a way to read the Bible is to read it from the inside out. Central core on out. Now, before you get stuck on that thing, let's go back. What we're doing now in function 1 is we are looking to the inner core, to the heart, to the kernel of the corn. Okay? Function 1 he calls primary literature. This is simple stuff. This is elementary. It is a non-negotiable storyline at the very heart of biblical faith. It is only for the insider. Okay? Nobody else. This is about us. Now, in the Old Testament, it's called Credo. In the New Testament, it's called Kerygma. Kernel stuff. We'll look at some Old Testament things. If you have a Bible, We've got five examples of Old Testament credo. Deuteronomy 26, 5 through 9. Deuteronomy 26, 5 through 9. Now, wouldn't that have been nice if they would have put this at the front? But that's where they put it. Way back here on page 218. You need help. Guggenheim's the kind of person that helps you read. Let me read Deuteronomy 26, 5. Then in the Lord's presence, you will recite these words. My ancestor was a wandering Aramean who took his family to Egypt to live. They were few in number when they went there, but they became a large and powerful nation. The Egyptians treated us harshly and forced us to work as slaves. Then we cried out for help to the Lord, the God of our ancestors. He heard us and saw our suffering and hardship and misery. And his great power and strength, and by his great power and strength, he rescued us from Egypt. He worked miracles and wonders and caused terrible things to happen. He brought us here and gave us this rich and fertile land. Okay? Now, if you would have just been reading through this thing on your own, that might not have jumped off the page. Brueggemann says, that's it. You are right at the heart. You're at the inside core of the Old Testament in that passage. The credo. He and other Old Testament scholars tell us what this little, these lines are. What he says they are is a liturgical confession that the people of Israel made before the altar. You and I go to Eucharist. After the sermon, what do? I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ. We say the creed. People have always had creeds. Israelites went to the altar, slaughtered the ox, and then what did they say? My father was a wandering Aramean. Okay? You get it? Mm-hmm. It's the creed. Kernel stuff. Credo. Everything spins off of the credo. Everything spins off of this thing. More examples of Old Testament credo. Deuteronomy 6:20. This is confirmation instruction for Jews. 6:20. In times to come, your children will ask, why did the Lord our God command us to obey all these laws? Then tell them, we were slaves of the king of Egypt, and the Lord rescued us by his great power. With our own eyes, we saw him work miracles and do terrifying things to the Egyptians and to their king and to all his officials. He freed us from Egypt to bring us here and give us this land, as he had promised our ancestors he would. And the Lord our God commanded us to obey all these laws and to have reverence for him. If we do, he will always watch over our nation and keep it prosperous. If we faithfully obey everything that God has commanded, he will be pleased with us. Does it sound the same? You notice the similarity?
Mm-hmm.
Both are about Egypt. Both are about deliverance. Both are some, I mean, we got how many lines here? About 12 lines that summarizes the history of Israel. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's confirmation instruction. Heart and core. Another example. Joshua 24. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Joshua 24. The whole chapter, or at least the first 13 verses. I'm not going to read all of this, but some. Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel together at Shechem. He called the elders and leaders and judges and officials. And they came into the presence of God, and Joshua said, ready? What are you expecting to hear right now?
Something about God brought our fathers out of
the
land of Egypt.
You got it. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, has to say. Long ago, your ancestors. Hear this?
Yeah.
It's the same story. You've heard this the third time.
It's obtuse.
It's not obtuse, is it?
No.
Long ago, your ancestors lived on the other side of the Euphrates River and worshipped other gods. One of those ancestors was Terah, the father of Abraham and Nahor. Then I took Abraham, your ancestor, from the land of the Euphrates and led him to the whole land of Canaan. I gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac. To Isaac gave Jacob, Esau. I gave Esau the hill country of Edom, his possessions by your ancestors. Jacob, his children, went down to Egypt. Later I sent Moses and Aaron, brought great trouble on Egypt, but I led you out. I brought your ancestors out of Egypt, and the Egyptians pursued them with what? chariots, it's right in the Bible, you got it. You already know the story, you see that? And cavalry. And when your ancestors got to the
Red Sea,
you know the story, you're not even looking at it. Wonderful. They cried out to me for help, and I put darkness between them and the Egyptians. I made the sea come rolling over the Egyptians and drown them. And you know what I did to Egypt.
Yeah.
Isn't that a great line? You know what I did to Egypt. Isn't that great?
I guess when they say it over and over again, we ought to know.
Yeah. All right. Exodus 15:1. This is called the Song of Moses. Now it was, maybe it was his song, but it was at least a song attributed to Moses. What do you think he's going to sing about? Oh, yeah, yeah. Pretty hard to get. I will sing to the Lord because he has won a glorious victory. He has thrown the horse and rider into the sea. The Lord is my strong defender. He is the one who has saved me. He is my God. I will praise him. My father's God. I will sing about his greatness. And it goes on and on and on. The Song of Moses. Credo. These statements of faith come before any theology, before any defense, or any explanation of the faith. Remember when we did parables? What did we say? Great proclamation was given in the form of simile. Remember? That was not explaining the faith, not defending the faith, not theology about the faith. Just take it or leave it, folks. That's it. We got delivered. If you don't like it, too bad. That's what this is all about. New Testament does the same thing. 1 Corinthians 1:23 is interesting for the kerygma now, for the kernel of the corn in the New Testament, we go to the oldest literature, which is 1 Corinthians and the writings of Paul. 1 Corinthians 1:23, a one-liner this time. As for us, we proclaim, now you're going to have some echoes here to John Schramm's theology of cross, theology of glory. As for us, we proclaim the crucified Christ, a message that is offensive to the Jews and nonsense to the Gentiles. For the Hebrew people, the core is we got out of Egypt. The core for the New Testament people is Jesus was crucified. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 3:1. Same thing is there. As a matter of fact, my brothers, I could not talk to you as I talk to people who have the spirit. I had to talk to you as though you belonged to this world, as children in the Christian faith. I had to... What am I doing here? Where is it? Yeah, that's not good enough, though. Well, let's skip that one. I must have had the wrong thing down. 1 Corinthians 15:3. I passed on to you what I received, which is of the greatest importance, colon, don't miss it, that Christ died for our sins, as written in the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised to life 3 days later, as is written in the Scriptures, that he appeared to Peter, then to the 12. He appeared more than 500 followers at once, most of whom are still alive, though some have died. Then he appeared to James, and afterward to all the apostles. Last of all, he appeared to me. The kerygma is, Jesus died, Jesus rose. That's the kernel of the corn. These two traditions have much in common, that is, the Old Testament and New Testament traditions. Both recite the acts of God. Recite, as in confirmation, as in creed, as in, let's learn the story. Come on, boys and girls. Come on, let's learn the story. That's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Both are confessions or assertions with no explanation, no defense, no nothing. Take it or leave it. Both say God is shaping history. Egypt, Jesus in Israel, Jesus in Palestine, both say God works in history. The essentials of all biblical faith are presented here. They shape public life and they shape personal experience. For Israel, this credo is a promise that was made to our fathers who were in trouble. It is that God delivered us from slavery to freedom with a show of power which defeated the strongest of people of the time. For Israel, it says that God led us into the wilderness, there nourished and sustained us how?
With bread.
For Israel, God brought us to a good land as promised. That's the core. For the church,
Jesus' death and resurrection means that the new age has come, that he was buried, that he will come again, that he is from David, that he rose on the third day, that the Spirit's been given, that he did it, that he died to deliver us from the present evil age, that he is exalted at the right hand of God. Bang. Okay, now that's... that he died. Did. Did die.
He did die.
Now, with that then, we are... you will hear these words again and again. Credo and kerygma. Just remember, credo is Old Testament, kerygma is New. That's the center, non-negotiable core. Now, second ring, out. Expanded narrative. The primary literature is now expanded, but not very carefully. Or very carefully, either. What happens in ring two is a more elaborate and complete presentation of the primary. For example, in the Old Testament, all of the literature from Exodus chapter 12 through all the literature in Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 50 expands one question. Will God keep his promise? No matter what you read in Genesis 12, 13, 14, 15, all the way through 50, underneath all those long, elaborate stories is one question. Will God keep his promise? The core says God keeps his promise, okay? That's credo. God delivers. God keeps promise. God keeps the covenant promise. What we've got out here now are long stories. Not always accurate, but long, beautiful stories that tell about the core. Expanded narrative. So you're reading along, Holly, and you say, what are we doing here? Well, what may be going on as you read both Old and New Testament is expansion of the core. We say that this is Genesis 12 through 50. This is also in the second ring. This is Matthew, this is Mark, Luke, and John. Okay? What are all these stories about Jesus for? His birth story. His walking on the water story. His feeding the 5. What are all those stories for? All of them must serve only one function, to expand the core. Mm-hmm. Get it?
Yeah.
Maybe I repeat myself 18 times and it's unnecessary.
The Bible
yeah.
does it, you don't sweat it.
What's that?
The Bible does it,
okay.
You don't sweat it.
New Testament example of this expanded narrative, cycling out from the center. Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all memories, this is important, all memories that the early church had are seen through the prism of the crucifixion and the resurrection. They knew that their Savior had been crucified and had come back. Now, with that focus, they say, let's expand the story. Mark starts back here when he's 30. Matthew says, no, let's go way back to the birth story. All of it, however, is oriented around the death and the resurrection. So they go back and they fill it all out. But we know the focus. Now, what you could... Yeah, yeah.
Would it be fair to say that the only reason that unless you accept that first core by faith or whatever, there's really no point in going over the rest of it?
Probably, yeah.
Because it's not going to bring you any closer to the core.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if your if a friend of yours is not a Christian person, you say, well... And they say, why should I believe? And you say, well, you ought to believe because Jesus walked on the water.
Mm-hmm. It's like what...
I mean, what's that going to do? That's
yeah.
not going to do anything. Who cares? Mm-hmm. They don't care.
It's like what Ruth said in Vespers last night, too, about the guy who, you know, could understand Aquinas and just all that. But, you know, and the one nun couldn't understand why he didn't believe. And he said, that's not what faith is.
That was a powerful story that Ruth told last night
mm-hmm.
about...
Mm-hmm.
about what's his name?
Mortimer
Adler, yeah. Beautiful story. Mm-hmm. When I think, you know, one of the questions that I kept asking myself as I was reading through Brueggemann here was to say, okay, how do you tell the story? I mean, do you say Jesus walked on water, so you ought to be a Christian too? I mean, who cares? And that's going to impress nobody. They're going to laugh at you.
Yeah.
They won't laugh at you. They'll say, it doesn't ring my bell. I think the only thing that makes any difference, but my conclusion is, to say, this story, the 6,000-year-old story, rings my bell because it has rung other people's bells.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can do is just invite you to examine the story and see how it's affecting history, the history of the world. Evangelism by rational manipulation or by coercion of some sort.
That ties into what we're going to talk about later. And it's real important because I always wondered about that. How do you make this? I mean, how do you tell somebody about something that's really important to you that it's just the core is Jesus was crucified.